What's the probably the most transformational policy that's been announced is the establishment of the digital Fort Knox for the United States and for the United States to begin building a Bitcoin treasury. To have the conversation around the idea is transformational for the global geopolitical position of Bitcoin.
You're listening to Because of Bitcoin, a podcast that shares the personal stories of how Bitcoin is having a real impact in people's lives, including mine. I'm your host, Mauricio Di Bartolomeo, the co-founder and CSO of Ledin. And without further ado, let's get started with today's story. Hello, everybody, and welcome back to season 3 of Because of Bitcoin. We have an amazing lineup of guests for you this season as we dive into the critical questions facing our industry and explore how Bitcoin is shaping the global economy. When I began my Bitcoin journey almost 10 years ago, I could see its potential, but I never imagined we'd be here in 2024 with US presidential candidates speaking at Bitcoin conferences. This year's Bitcoin conference in Nashville featured 2 presidential candidates and 8 US senators, a clear sign that Bitcoin is front and center in the upcoming US election. With the US at the epicenter of global financial markets, the policies shaped during this election will have far-reaching implications and consequences for Bitcoin and crypto worldwide. To kick off this season, we're talking to guests who are helping shape these policies on both sides. And today, I'm thrilled to welcome David Bailey, CEO of Bitcoin Media and the driving force behind the Bitcoin conference in Nashville, where Republican nominee and former President Donald Trump made a landmark appearance. David has been working closely with the Trump campaign to influence the policies being crafted around Bitcoin. In this episode, he gives us an inside look at how Donald Trump operates and how the industry is working with his party. Without further ado, here's my conversation with David Bailey. All right. Mr. David Bailey, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me on the show.
There's so many things I want to talk to you today about, but I want to start, as I usually do in the show, with a little bit of the origin story and getting into the weeds of what it was like to grow up as David Bailey. And can you tell us what it was like to, what your childhood was like and what the Bailey household was like and anything that sticks out to you?
So I've done a lot of podcasts over the past 10 years, and this is the first time anyone has ever asked me about my upbringing. So thank you for the original question. Yeah, I guess, ever since I was a child, I had an infatuation with the concept of money, not necessarily having money, but the concept of money. I grew up in my parents' small business after school, and I would take green paper and I would photo print different denominations of fake currency. I had a little truck as like a small child that was also a bank, and I would collect pennies in the bank and I'd play bank. So just from childhood, I enjoyed money, investing, and how money was the mechanism by which the world ordered and organized itself, in a very, let's say, infantile way of understanding that. And I also, I mentioned my parents had a small business. They published a magazine called Homes and Land Magazine, which is like it's a magazine you find outside of gas stations that's like in a box, that kind of looks like a real estate. So they did that for the city of Huntsville, Alabama. So Huntsville is a town of 200,000 people. And so it was just, a small business. I think they had at their peak, maybe 3 people working for them. And so I grew up in that environment after school. I would bag magazines for my dad, who would go out and distribute them. And, I saw my dad build, the business, the things that he cared about, his kind of ethics and ideals about how to run a small business. And then likewise, my mom, she's a force of nature in her own, but she's extremely charismatic. She wouldn't call it sales, but she's great at sales. She's also just an amazing woman. So I grew up around them, getting to just see them build a business. And I feel like that had a pretty big influence on me. And then probably the other formative event that occurred. So I got into investing the summer before my freshman year of high school. And so I had saved up like $4,000, and my dad matched the $4,000 I had saved. And so I had $8,000. And so I started investing into stocks when I was, that would have made me 13 years old or something like that with $8,000. And so, you know, my first run with investing into stocks, I invested into the companies I knew, which was Apple, Google, and once Google IPO'd, and, you know, things that just a kid would know. And those stocks did extremely well. So, I bought Apple before the first iPhone came out, and I turned the $8,000 into a fair chunk of change. While I was in high school, over $100,000 investing into stocks, and I thought I was amazing. Then I started investing into bank stocks, and this was like 2007, 2008. You know, banks had started coming down in the price a little bit, but they were down like maybe 20% or 30% from their all-time highs. And, you know, at this point in time in my childhood, I was watching a bunch of CNBC and, you know, mainstream news. And this was before I realized that, like, the world is designed to lie to you. So, you know, I'm still like, I believe things at face value. Like when a CEO goes on, you know, CNBC and says, buy our stock, it's super safe, you know. I'm like, oh, wow, I listened to an interview with the CEO. This was my first kind of lesson in life that, you know, boy, I guess going from a boy to a man, where I proceeded to lose huge sums of money in the 08, 09 financial crisis. And, you know, when you lose $100,000 as a 16, 17 year old, that has a pretty formative impression on your perspective. And so that led me down a path of trying to understand why this happened. How is it that no one saw the financial crisis coming? How is it that no one knew subprime mortgages would blow up? And it turns out that there were people that knew, you know, there were people who talked about this way before it happened. And when I found those people's videos on YouTube and on the, you know, people talking about it on the internet, it's like, this person knew, you know, how did they know and no one else knew? That led me to Austrian economics. That led me to the path that ultimately brought me to Bitcoin. And so there's actually a very formative video I watched from Ron Paul, where he's on the floor of the house giving a speech about the subprime crisis. And I think it's 2001 or 2002. He's giving this speech about how, you know, this is going to cause a mortgage bubble. The mortgage bubble is going to pop. It's going to bring down the financial institutions. And he like lays it out. And it's like, oh, okay. So people did understand that this was going to happen, but these people just had a certain worldview. And so then I started to try to understand what their worldview was. And, you know, there was other things that happened in my life, but that is ultimately how I came to Bitcoin. So my journey to Bitcoin is really a journey that started really, I guess, like summer after the eighth grade, you know, and maybe even earlier than that. And it built to me getting into Bitcoin my senior year of college. I bought my first Bitcoins in November of 2012 and have been along on the ride ever since.
Wow, man, what an answer. For all the Bitcoin parents out there, what you do today is so important for the future of your child. And I think you just embody that. I've had similar, you know, experiences with my parents growing up. I grew up around an entrepreneurial household, which eventually led us to, you know, led me to have the guts really to start my own business and to build Ledin into what it is today with Adam and everyone else that's kind of been on this journey. But it's so important what you see in those early days and how you want to meme and mimic your parents. So to all the Bitcoin parents out there, they're watching you. So act as a Bitcoiner would.
I mean, I think you have to be kind of a psychopath to start a business, or you have to not know anything else, you know? And it's like, you know, and when I started the business, like so I was in college. I went to the first, you know, I bought Bitcoin in November of 2012, roughly $10 a Bitcoin. Bitcoin runs all the way to $266. That was April of 2013. So it's like my second semester of my senior year, and I've 25x'd my money in 4 months. And so I just don't care about school anymore. I don't care about, it's just like nothing else matters. And then the price of Bitcoin crashes from like $260 to like $50 in a day. And so, you know, people think these bear markets are bad. They have no idea, you know, what came before. So I get wrecked on Bitcoin, or not wrecked, but I mean, I'm down a lot. And I'm like, oh, wow, like, am I an idiot? Like, did I buy into a bubble? You know, and so I went to the first Bitcoin conference that was in San Jose, 2013. This was May. And, you know, I was going, I tried to get a job or find if there's somebody was hiring for a job. No one was hiring because no one had any money. But I actually interviewed to be employee number one at Coinbase. They didn't have enough money to hire me. So I, was kind of like, okay, well, I guess I'll do my own thing. And, you know, when the people I met at this conference, they were like the smartest people I had ever met. And I felt like I had met really smart people in my career. You know, I had interned at hedge funds, I'd interned at venture capital shops. So like, I felt like I knew smart people. And the people at the Bitcoin conference were an order of magnitude smarter. And it wasn't even people that were there for work. It was people that had called in sick to their work and made up some excuse. Because at this point in time, it was still like not okay to tell people that you were into Bitcoin. They're like, you know, drug money, pot, you know what? So they all would like make up excuses. And these were like Google engineers and Adobe engineers and like, you know, people who had real jobs. And like Bitcoin is their total passion. And they're working on it at nights. They're working on it on weekends. They're lying to their boss to come to the Bitcoin conference. And it's like, wow, like there's 1,000 of the smartest people I've ever met. Like in this room, the energy and the excitement of the moment was like, you know, I actually remember coming back from, we all went and watched the new Star Trek movie together, which is like so nerdy, but that was part of the conference.
What a Bitcoiner thing to do.
Yeah. And so I come back into the lobby and it's like, let's say like 1 a.m. in the morning, and the lobby is packed with people in like groups of like 3 or 4 or 5 people huddled together in little circles that are like brainstorming businesses that they're going to start, like startups. And there's like, you know, 20 or 30 little groups of like 3 to 5 people that are like coming up with ideas. And it was like the energy of anything is possible. Like we can build anything with this. This is the start of a whole new system. It was so exciting that I was like, if I don't focus on this full time, if I don't go all in on this, I will live for the rest of my life with the regret that I was there at that moment and I didn't do it. And worst case scenario is this goes to zero. And then I'm just like every other college student who has, you know, no life experience or skills or whatever. And, you know, I just go back to school. So I jumped full time into it from May 2013 as my total focus. And I started with a magazine called Why Bitcoin, because I didn't know what else to do. So I was just like, okay, I grew up, my parents did magazines, like maybe I can do a magazine. And so the magazine was just like, what is Bitcoin? How does it work? What is Bitcoin mining? Where can I spend it? Why should I accept it? How high, like what's the potential value of it? Like just the basics, you know, but in a magazine format. And so that was like it was the worst idea ever. Like, I mean, honestly, if I could go back, if I could go back, I'd start the business you started. Okay. But I wasn't smart enough to do that. So I got into print magazines, but I quickly learned that print magazines are not the best business, and I diversified into other businesses. But yeah, so that's like my journey into Bitcoin, my path. And what was interesting about it, I'd say, is like a print magazine, first off, in our industry, like nothing is in print anymore. So it's really weird to have a print magazine. So it almost like helped me stick out. Like everyone in Bitcoin can build a domain, you know, everyone in Bitcoin can, but very few people have magazines. So like it did help me. And what it also gave me was a reason to talk to every single person in the industry. So I talked to every company, I talked to every author, I was basically traveling the world for 2 or 3 years in a row, going to every single Bitcoin conference that happened in the world and every Bitcoin meetup, you know, and just, I went to hundreds of conferences. I mean, not hundreds, at least 800 conferences back to 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 back. So, and you don't really have a reason to do that unless you have like a job in media. I mean, maybe, you know, maybe some companies do, but, you know, mostly people have a couple conferences that matter and then they don't go to the rest. And I was trying to just meet people. So I just went to every single one. And so that's kind of like where my path started once I got into Bitcoin.
Such an amazing story, man. And I find myself nodding because I find a lot of similarities between what how your journey was and how my journey was in terms of mimicking what my parents did. Like I grew up watching my dad short the bolívar using dollars. And when I found Bitcoin, to me, the natural thing was to short a dollar using Bitcoin. Like I was just, it was instant. Like I just knew that that's what I wanted to mimic. And how do I do that? I need to set up a loan. And this is what I ended up doing. And it's fascinating how you saw, you know, you found Bitcoin, you know, you want to be a part of it. The natural inclination for you was to do what your dad had done, which is to start a magazine. And I find this, it's such an interesting path. And similarly, I commend and applaud anyone that lives or grows up around stable currency and finds Bitcoin as early as you did. Typically, it's because something happened where money was weaponized or property rights failed you or fairness of markets failed you. And there it is. Like you explained the situation with your bank investment and how you kind of have found that, you know, came to Jesus or came to Ron and found, you know, the answers. And it's such a, it's history rhymes, you know, it doesn't repeat, but it rhymes. And it's so fascinating. So now we're here, you started the magazine, you've done all these conferences. How does the opportunity to buy Bitcoin magazine come up? And did you have to interact at any point with Vitalik as part of that negotiation? Could you tell us a little bit about how that went down?
Yeah. So Vitalik's now too big of a cheese to spend time hanging out with me. But in the early days, I knew Vitalik well. I met Vitalik through a gentleman named Mihai. Mihai, can't pronounce his last name, Romanian guy. One of the original co-founders of Bitcoin Magazine. And Mihai had hired Vitalik to write content for Bitcoin Magazine. So I met them at an Amsterdam conference in 2013. I remember Mihai introducing me to Vitalik and was like, "You're never going to believe how smart this nerd is." And just like, you know, me and I were not like the developer types, and Vitalik was just like pure autistic, like brilliant. And so we're hanging out, and that was my first interaction with Vitalik. And they were already kind of talking about wanting to do something. I think Vitalik was one of the co-authors on the Colorcoin white paper. And at this point in time, like color coins were a big topic in Bitcoin. You know, a lot of people were talking about Bitcoin 2.0. meta layers on Bitcoin. There was something called Omni, which at that time was called Mastercoin. So people were already thinking about how do we build smart contracts for Bitcoin. And so that's where the relationship started. The relationship grew over time, just because we're both doing magazines. I was kind of smoking them in terms of commercialization. And you know, I had some innovative tactics, like we had a phone number that you could call and I would pick up the phone. Whereas, you know, Bitcoin Magazine, you could email them 1,000 times, they'd never respond to you. Like, you know, just, it's, you know, they're running as a passion business. One formative event happened in December of 2013. There was a conference in Las Vegas, Inside Bitcoin's Las Vegas. And I was situated, there was three kind of booths back to back. Bitcoin Magazine was on the right. I was in the middle. And then to my left was a booth called CryptoKit. And CryptoKit was run by a guy named Anthony DiOrio. And so Anthony and I became friends, like very close friends right away. I ended up connecting Anthony and Vitalik together at that event, which is where Vitalik explained to Anthony the concept of Ethereum. Anthony had just sold his company called Satoshi Circle or something like that. It was a betting platform. And so Anthony just committed to investing right there. And that was the start of really Ethereum's beginning. So the group of people that came together to build Ethereum were a lot of people that I knew well. I hung out with at these conferences. Some of them are well known. A few of them, you know, like to stay out of podcasts and rather not have their names said out loud. But you know, so I would hang out with all of these people and just as friends. And some point in time during this process, my girlfriend at the time from college, who's now my wife, started working at a company called BitPay. I think that happened in 2014. and BitPay was floating Bitcoin Magazine's expenses as part of some deal that Tony Gallippi had put together. And so when Vitalik and Mihai decided, hey, we're going to go do this Ethereum thing, we need to like get out of our Bitcoin Magazine commitments, BitPay is like, what the fuck? We've been floating you all this money to do Bitcoin Magazine. Like, what are we supposed to do? So like, and so BitPay is like trying to think of a solution. And my wife is just walking by, or my, at that time, my girlfriend, walking by the CFO's office. And the CFO is like, hey, Emily, do you think your boyfriend would buy Bitcoin Magazine? And she was like, probably. And so that was the beginning of that process. And I negotiated a deal with Vitalik and Mihai. You know, it was a little bit of a tense situation because they weren't on the best terms with BitPay, and BitPay was the ultimate kind of decider of what happened. And I didn't have the money to pay for Bitcoin Magazine. So I had to figure out a way to get the money before I had to deliver the money. So I negotiated a deal where I paid, you know, I got them out of all of their liabilities that they had. They owed all these magazines and these advertising credits that they had pre-sold. So I took on all those liabilities and I paid them $50,000 for Bitcoin Magazine, but I didn't have 50 grand. So I split it into three payments of $16,000 that were due every 6 weeks or something like that, every 4 weeks. And I pre-sold 20 grand worth of advertising to cover my first payment on Bitcoin Magazine. And so, you know, I hustled the whole thing together and I actually had a promise. It's in the contract, I think, that like after 2 years, I had to also agree to pay Vitalik and Mihai $10,000 a piece. I actually reread the contract a couple of years ago and I forgot that I was supposed to pay them. So I reached out to both of them. Both of them are like mega rich now. And I'm like, hey, by the way, I need to pay you $10,000. Can I pay you in Bitcoin? Neither of them responded to me. So I still owe them that money. If either of them hear this podcast, you know, would love to follow through on the deal.
Wow, man. What a story. And I like to talk to you because people tend to forget how closely linked Ethereum and Bitcoin and crypto, we were all one and the same in the early days, in the early enough days. There was no them versus us. This was all one tent. And I think having that context is what, why you do so well, what you do, which I find you act as a bridge among crypto as a whole, even though you run Bitcoin Magazine. And we'll get into that in a second, because I think that that is a very mature thing. That's a very forward-thinking way of being, and that's very much aligned with how I feel and I view things. Damn, you've kind of run through so many things that I wanted to ask you, but in a great way.
That's exactly right. The reason that we have the cultural values that we have at Bitcoin Magazine for the Bitcoin conference, it dates back to the early culture of Bitcoin. We've always tried to basically bring back the OG Bitcoin culture. And you know, before everything was trying to compete with Bitcoin, because the early stuff wasn't even trying to compete with Bitcoin. You know, it wasn't Bitcoin. You know, like Bitcoin was the mothership. Everything else was just like a child of Bitcoin. And so we've always tried to bring back that culture. And, you know, we also try to bring back like the vibe of the Bitcoin conference, which was very positive and optimistic about the future. And we can build it. We can do it. Nothing's impossible. If Bitcoin can't scale, we'll figure out how to scale it. If Bitcoin can't do smart contracts, we'll figure out how to do smart contracts. Like it was very much a we'll fucking do it. Like that's what I think the culture needs to be, rather than kind of like this, oh, Bitcoin can't do smart contracts, so therefore smart contracts are dumb and not worth pursuing, and you know, forget even trying to do smart contracts on Bitcoin. You know, we borrow the cultural values from, you know, our upbringing in Bitcoin, I guess. If we did it any other way, it'd kind of be just fake, because it's not even what we know. I mean, we don't even know how to do it this other way, where it's like Bitcoin is the holy, you know, coin and everything else is going straight to hell. That's not to say that I over this past 10 years, 13 years in Bitcoin, I've grown to respect and appreciate Bitcoin in so many new ways that I didn't understand it at first in that same light. And so, you know, for us, why we're Bitcoin only is because we think Bitcoin deserves that focus and attention. It can be so much, but we're not Bitcoin maxis in the sense of it's not that we don't want these other things to be successful. And it's not that we don't think that there's, you know, features or things that could be improved upon. We definitely think there are. We just think that Bitcoin deserves our utmost prioritization.
Thank you for sharing that. And it's so eye-opening and refreshing to hear that from an OG and a Bitcoiner like yourself in terms of this sort of big tent Bitcoiner view, which I like to subscribe. I don't really know if that's the right name for it. But like here, like if you wind back the clock far enough, all of us have something to do with Ethereum eventually, right? Like that's a picture of me going to the University of Toronto information sessions on Ethereum mining. And again, I was back then, I was a Bitcoiner, I was new to the space. I learned a lot through those sessions, and we shouldn't be, I think we're all rowing towards, we have a lot more in common than we do in differences, right? And so I think that's what you try to bring to the table. And I love that about you and your conferences. Now let's talk about the conferences for a second, because thinking about, you know, on the topic of we'll fucking do it regardless, if you had asked me 2 years ago that two presidential candidates and eight senators are going to be at a Bitcoin conference in a presidential year, I would have told you that you are out of your mind. Yet somehow you brought on two presidential candidates to speak at a Bitcoin conference, the biggest Bitcoin conference in the world. And I would be remiss if I didn't ask you at least one question about this. So do you think that Donald Trump and his advisors genuinely get Bitcoin and are excited about it? Or is he a smart politician? And maybe I would love to get your take on that, because you've spent a lot of time interacting with him in the campaign.
Well, first off, thank you for the shout out. You know, what's cool about it is that we didn't set out to get two presidents to the conference. We set out to just do our utmost to push Bitcoin, and the opportunity developed, and then we just seized the opportunity. And RFK was a byproduct of, you know, do you remember the trucker protest in Canada?
Very well.
So we were one of the driving forces behind raising money for the truckers, and we helped raise 10 Bitcoins for Honk Honk. I think it was called Honk Honk Bitcoin or something like that. And so RFK saw that. And RFK, of course, the COVID, the vaccine is near and dear to his heart. And so that was the eye-opening moment for him of you know, you can't have freedom if you can't control your own money. And that's ultimately what brought him to our conference in 2023. And we built the relationship. And the Trump campaign saw that activity. And that was actually one of the big things that really helped us in terms of closing the deal for getting Trump engaged for 2024, just that we were a platform where, you know, presidential candidates spoke. And so, you know, the process with Trump has been very interesting, because I'm a pretty anti-government, anti-politics. I got into Bitcoin to separate money and state. So like I truly believe in that vision. And working with the political system in some way has reinforced my worst impressions of politics, but has also opened my mind to the fact that individuals can achieve a lot within the political system, just like individuals can achieve a lot within the Bitcoin system. Like, we act like they can't, but like, two guys built Coinbase, you know, like CZ built Binance. Like, you can go build products and services that onboard 100 million users, and there's nothing stopping you. And so the political system is not that dissimilar in the sense of, like, you know, you can have a big impression if you attack it with ideas that have product market fit, and Bitcoin has product market fit. So anyway, like, directly to your question of, does Trump understand it, and do his advisors understand it? We pitched Bitcoin to Trump and his team as an opportunity. it's easy to say that somebody is being opportunistic. Oh, they're only doing this to benefit themselves. The reality is that almost every person, I'd say every person who gets Bitcoin is doing it to benefit themselves. You know, like it takes a special type of person to see the opportunity where others do not. And so Donald Trump and his team see the opportunity with Bitcoin. Do they necessarily understand it in full, the full gravity of it? Every day they go further down the path. That's all I can say. I mean, it's like, I don't think any person who gets into Bitcoin in their first 3 months understands the gravity of what it can become. There's also a lot of people in Trump's orbit. And so different people in Trump's orbit have different levels of understanding. And there are people in his family that own significant amounts of Bitcoin who have been trying to get, you know, their family aligned on Bitcoin for a while. So it's not something that we did by ourselves. There's a lot of kind of voices there, but we created, like, let's say the specific catalyst for like a forcing function of Trump really saying, is this something that is aligned with my beliefs that I can get behind, and that I, and is it a big enough opportunity for me to bother prioritizing it? And as he understood how many people own this thing, how many, like, you know, the potential of what Bitcoin can do for the United States, the size of the market, he really embraced it. And then every time he embraced it, the market reacted, it reinforced that decision. Like every time he said something about it, everyone would ask him about it in his personal life. The media would go wild. The crowds would cheer. Like, he loves that. That's how he feeds off the crowd. He's a true entertainer in that sense. And so, like, when you know, Gary Gensler's death sentence was when Donald Trump went and said on day one he'll fire Gary Gensler, and the crowd went wild. Like, that was the end for Gary Gensler right there. As soon as the crowd went wild, if the crowd had not responded at all, you know, he'd be like, they don't like that idea. Like throw it in the back burner. But as soon as the crowd went wild, it's like, okay, we're doing this. So that's the type of guy that Trump is. He's an entrepreneur. If the users like something from the product, he'll double down. If the users don't like it, he'll incorporate the feedback, you know? So
I could not agree with you more. And I think that's a really great analogy in terms of politics and platforms having product market fit. Like, you see it with Javier Milei. Like, Javier Milei in Argentina created a party out of nothing in 3 years, and now he's the president of Argentina and dethroned the two parties that have been basically passing each other the baton for decades. So politics, to your point, as imperfect as it is, allows for change if the right people get involved with the right sort of platform. Now, just to get a little bit specific on Trump, because now I think we're talking, we talked loosely about it, but there's a chance that a US president for the first time has Bitcoin on his political platform and is going to be expected to take action should he get elected, right? And so can you, at a very high level, talk about, like, what are some of his key policies around Bitcoin? And is there one in particular that excites you the most?
I don't want to share anything that's been shared with me in confidence by the president or his team. And I don't want to front run any future announcements that they're going to have. I can tell you that, you know, when we first started pitching the campaign on Bitcoin and what it means and what it could do for them and why it's aligned with their platform, they asked us to, like, you know, put together potential policy items that would excite the Bitcoin community that would be aligned with their policy platform that already existed. And we put together, like, just, we threw kind of the entire kitchen sink at it. Like, every idea that had been talked about from our industry that, you know, you would think is totally impractical. And it's like, if we can get one out of the kitchen sink, people would be thrilled. And so we sent over this list and they're like, yeah, these look great. We like them. And it's like, yeah, like, well, which one do you like? They're like, we like all of them. So, like, I think in terms of what the platform is and what it can be, I think that anything is possible. I think that as long as our industry and our users show up for Trump, everything is on the table. And I mean that in there is no idea that is too ambitious where Trump says that's too ambitious. I'm not interested. Trump loves ambitious ideas. Trump loves the Louisiana purchase. You know, Trump loves the transformational deal. And so, you know, he also, he wants to be remembered as a president that changed the course of history. And, you know, it might sound cheesy, but there are very few things that can actually change the course of history. Rewriting the global monetary standard is one of those things. And so, you know, it's, so I think like what the platform is today, it will expand in scope dramatically over time. You know, what he's announced today so far, you know, first and foremost, free Ross Ulbricht on day one, which he will 100% follow through on. If he doesn't follow through on that, everyone deserves to walk away and say, you know, F this guy. He will follow through on that promise. So next policy that he's spoken publicly about is he will defend Bitcoin miners from regulation. He will ensure that all companies in the United States have equal access to energy, that they won't be discriminated against because of how they choose to use energy. And he wants Bitcoin to be mined in America. So that's the second policy that he's announced. He's announced that he will protect your right to run a node, your right to mine, and your right to self-custody Bitcoin. So what that looks like in policy equivalence, he hasn't shared any policy around that, but those are high-level campaign promises. He's promised to fire Gary Gensler on day one. We already talked about that one, but he's very excited about that. So I was hoping he was going to say in his speech, "Gary Gensler, you're fired." But, you know, they didn't go full Monty. And then I think what's probably the most transformational policy that's been announced that also has the most room for, let's say, scope growth, scope creep, you could say, is the establishment of the digital Fort Knox for the United States and for the United States to begin building a Bitcoin treasury. And, you know, I think that idea is not only extremely exciting, but I think that it's just the to have the conversation around the idea is transformational for the global geopolitical position of Bitcoin. And to me shows the fact that it so quickly became something that was absurd that and then became plausible. You know, even if it's not certain, it's plausible. To me, says that it is an inevitability that it will happen. I think like that is really where Bitcoin kind of enters the next level of adoption.
The Overton window has been open, and now we just got to bust through it. I think when it comes to Bitcoin as a national reserve, so that's I thank you for sharing that, and we you know. There's a lot of anticipation to see what happens in this election and sort of what the future holds for Bitcoin. I want to talk to you or ask you briefly about something you mentioned in a previous interview, which was that the Bitcoin political lobby has been working closely with the crypto political lobby, and that this was key to advance both groups' agendas. And we at LedIn support both Bitcoin and Ethereum, and we've been members of both Bitcoin industry associations and crypto industry associations, and I get the tension. There always has been a tension, and there's this sort of false idea that we are all rooting for different things. But I think that in order for everyone or anyone to advance our platforms or advance our projects, we need to understand the game theory of democracy and act accordingly. And in the game theory of democracy, power is in numbers. So I think it's key to bring these two lobbies together rather than to fragment them, because, you know, if they divide us, it'll make everyone's lives much more difficult. So can you speak to what it's been like to work or bridge those two lobbies together to find common ground? And do you foresee more unity or more of a drift in the years to come?
I see much more unity happening. And, you know, really the only politically mobilized part of the Bitcoin industry is the Bitcoin miners. The vast majority of the corporate political activity outside of miners is from the crypto world. The reality is that there are more Bitcoin users than any other crypto. And the reality is that every crypto person loves Bitcoin. Almost every crypto person loves Bitcoin. And so, you know, while the Bitcoin maxis like to pretend that's like not the case, there really just isn't that much divide. And the policy issues that they care about are roughly the same, absent proof of work. So proof of work is the one place where I think they're unique, even though proof of stake does have the same double taxation issue that proof of work does. So there are some similarities there on the consensus side. I think a couple things. I think one is that, you know, the gravitas and excitement and the necessity around this moment brought people together. Like when you're doing big things to change the world, it's like the little petty stuff. It just comes off as so petty. Like, who cares? Who fucking cares? And so that's like very, very quickly it's unifying. Then I think Trump nailed it right off the bat by making his first policy item freeing Ross Ulbricht, because that's a very unifying message that goes all the way back, harkens all the way back to the early days of Bitcoin, you know, like this like earlier ethos of Bitcoin. And then, you know, Trump has done a great job of recognizing both Bitcoin and crypto, not necessarily making them the exact same thing. And I think what I see coming, which I think will permanently change this toxicity between the two groups, is Bitcoin is digital money. It's digital value. It's digital gold. And crypto is digital securities. And the whole crypto industry like shrieks to being called a security because, like, you know, there's so much, you know, bullshit put up to pretend you're not a security. Like, people are buying these things for reasons other than to speculate. But I think once we have the clarity of regulations that say it is perfectly fine for a crypto to be a security, it's perfectly fine to just promise investors things and follow through on those promises and to have a team that runs the project and to make a profit and all the things that the Howey test says you can't go and do, it will clarify the situation that these things are not competitors to Bitcoin. They're complements to Bitcoin. You know, it's not like people sit on Wall Street and complain about the US dollar, you know, being a competitor to the stock market. You know, or that, you know, the Dow and the US dollar are in conflict. One is built upon the other. The growth of one is the growth of the other. And so what the issue is that because everyone has to pretend that crypto isn't a security, then it has to pretend it's something that it's not. And it gets interpreted by the Bitcoin community as like, oh, you think you're Bitcoin 2.0. You think you're a better Bitcoin. And that's not what they're trying to be. It's not what they should be. And I think a lot of the scamming that happens in crypto would just disappear if instead of having to pretend you're something that you're not, from the beginning, the crypto could just be honest of like, yeah, we're using this as a vehicle to coordinate human activity so we can go build something and incentivize our users and incentivize our employees. Once you clarify what it's supposed to be, like people, the most profitable action is to act honestly. You know, like, so I see this coming together, and I actually think Trump could be the champion who pushes for and forces through with a baseball bat truly transformational regulatory change on securities laws.
That's really well said, man. And I really appreciate you bringing up those analogies, because I think it's really helpful for people to clarify. It's not that we're all trying to compete and eat from the same cake. We're trying to grow the cake together. Everyone, there are different slices of the cake, I guess, and we just all have to grow the pie together. I think that's really well said.
One of the most powerful ideas of Bitcoin, you know, I've always loved the idea of the ICO. You know, it's an IPO. It's a public offering anywhere in the world. You could be a farmer in the middle of Africa, and you can have a business idea, and you can go on the internet, and you can pitch strangers, and you could have 10,000 or 100,000 people around the world pitch in $10. And it's like, that is such a superpower of Bitcoin. Like fiat can't do that. Credit cards can't do that. Nothing can do that. And it's like, once we unlock the Bitcoin capital markets, like once people can... like once we embrace that Bitcoin is this tool for transferring value for all the same use cases that the capital markets compete for today, dude, we unlock like the next level in the economy, in human potential. Like it's like we can't let these amazing ideas get sacrificed at the feet of like some fucking fake purity. That's not even, you know, real.
Thank you, man. Honestly, as a founder that was born and raised outside of the United States, I grew up looking at starting a business and taking it public as a kid would look as window shopping through FAO Schwartz in New York. There's just looking through the window of things that you will never be able to buy, never be able to do just because you weren't born in the right place or the right parents. And to see that people from where I grew up, people from Asia now everywhere, it used to be, it's so funny because I'm seeing, I was writing about this for something else, but 10 years ago, it was like, you're either in the US or you have no access to financial opportunity. Right now, because so much innovation has been pushed abroad, Americans are actually aching to say, Americans are being the ones getting kicked out of financial innovation because you're not allowing that innovation to happen here. And this is why we're also intensely discussing politics here so that we can fix that, because Americans have always been used to having access to everything. And right now they're circumstantially in a situation where there's things that they cannot touch, and that's where the financial opportunity is. So it's fascinating to your point how Bitcoin has really shifted things and making us have to kind of rethink how financial, what is fair in financial systems. That was great. That really got me going. Through this process, you also spoke to the Blues, to the Democrat campaign. Can you tell us a little bit about what that experience was like? Because it seems that Bitcoin embodies or espouses the values that they should be championing in terms of democratizing access to capital and freedom money. What is it that they don't get, or what is it that's missing, or how have those interactions been? Are we misunderstanding their posture? Is there a chance that they're actually thinking about this the right way, but maybe their actions don't reflect that yet? Is there anything you can share on that side?
They're not thinking about it. The right people are not thinking about it the right way. There absolutely is a progressive case for Bitcoin. In fact, you know, we published a book at Bitcoin Magazine. I am the actual publisher of the progressive case for Bitcoin. So, you know, don't let anyone accuse me of being, you know, just a partisan hack. No, the progressives have an incredible case for how Bitcoin champions their causes. There are some brilliant progressive and liberal thinkers that have really articulated the case well. I think what's happened is you know, a couple fold. One is the libertarians were kind of the first group and party to Bitcoin, and libertarians are disproportionately in the conservative camps. And so I think that the infiltration of Bitcoin to conservative ideology, to conservative institutions, it started earlier and in a bigger way. And so it's just had a head start, let's say, with the conservatives. I think what also happened is that the Democrats, in the same way that, let's say, the Republican Party of the past was not really conservative, the Democratic Party today is not really liberal. And there is going to come a political, let's put it like this, you know, the roots of Bitcoin are the Tea Party and Occupy Wall Street. That's the roots of Bitcoin. And the Tea Party has taken over the Republican Party. And Occupy Wall Street has not taken over the Democratic Party yet. But the populist calling for a money system that works for all people, that all people have access to, it will ultimately take root and win out the Democratic Party. Like that, in my opinion, is an inevitability because the status quo isn't sustainable. And so while the current Democratic Party has, like, let's say, delegated its financial policy to Elizabeth Warren, who hates Bitcoin on environmental grounds and whatever other grounds, I don't even know. I think now that they've seen how much traction the Trump has gotten, the Republican Party has gotten, they've realized the stakes have risen dramatically, and that it matters having an opinion on this. And an uninformed opinion that's anti-Bitcoin, anti-crypto, doesn't win you votes, doesn't get you donations. It's really counterproductive. And so, you know, if Elizabeth Warren hadn't already, you know, anchored the party to such an anti-Bitcoin view, I think they already would have pivoted on their perspective. And I think the next political leader that comes outside of the, you know, Kamala Harris is the VP for Joe Biden. So it's like, she is the Joe Biden ticket, the Joe Biden platform. The next Democrat that runs, that's not part of the Joe Biden platform and is a fresh voice or a fresh face, they're going to be aligned with Bitcoin from the progressive perspective. And so I think it's very important that progressive Bitcoiners who are listening to this or just in general are interested in this topic, they need to be articulating the progressive talking points over and over and over and over again so that they can give the intellectual foundation for the next Democrat to embrace Bitcoin. But if they don't have the intellectual foundation, it's not like they're going to adopt the Republican talking points on Bitcoin. So we just have to develop them and talk about them. And it's really, well, I did publish, you know, I am the publisher of a progressive case for Bitcoin. I've tied my anchor to the Trump ship and the Republican Party for this election. And so it's up to some other Bitcoiner out there to, you know, take up the mantle and take the talking points and make the case for the progressive case.
That's well said, and thank you for sharing that. We're coming up on time, and I have so many questions that I still want to run you, but I'll Greg you on for another episode. Moving away from politics for a second and back into Bitcoin culture, you may not know this, but Bitcoin Magazine and the Bitcoin Conference was one of the few media outlets that gave us a voice when we were getting started. And it was on the merit of our work, not on the merit of our marketing dollars, which back then we didn't have that much. We were just six guys that raised a small seed round, $1.5 million, and just trying to build a business and always under the shadow of some of the bigger guys. And I keep this as a memoir because I wanted to show you at this conference. I wanted to show you this during the podcast. So do you remember this?
Yes, of course.
This is your industry map for 2019.
Yes, of course.
And back then, in the lending division of the city, all you had was BlockFi, who ironically, we made an offer to purchase when they were going under. But they ended up taking the FTX bid. But it's funny that 5 years later, and we are going to be in Vegas, and we are going to be the epicenter of the lending map in Vegas. And it's beautiful to see what 5 years does to an industry. And I thank you guys immensely for all the support. You've got some great Bitcoiners in your shop going through CK and now Frank Corva and a bunch of others. Isa, there's too many to name. You guys have brought on, like, you're like the farm team of the Barcelona. You just pump out Bitcoin superstars and just release them into the wild. And it's been really, really awesome to see. So I, for one, want to thank you on behalf of the Bitcoin community and myself. And my question to you is, you guys always do bigger and better. What can we expect from Vegas in 2025?
Well, so we have ideas of how to go bigger and better. There was at least one major surprise for Bitcoin 2024 that didn't happen, that was supposed to happen. And so we're hoping that it happens for 2025. And, you know, I do think that if Trump wins, it's going to be one hell of a show. And if Kamala wins, it's going to be one hell of a show, but with a slightly different flavor to it, let's say. So, I think, you know, we're ready for the next chapter of Bitcoin to begin. And we're ready to see things go to the next level. And I hope that next year's conference can be a celebration of Bitcoin 250K. And I think that, you know, there's been a very interesting people that have reached out after our work with Trump from around the world. And I think that, you know, what you've seen from Trump is just a taste of what's to come. And I hope 25 is twice as big in every single way. Media, attendees, sponsors, announcements, impact in the world. I will say this year's conference for Nashville, we had, I think it's 18 billion impressions for the conference. So it's going to be hard to 2x that. That's, you know, that would be 6 impressions per person on the planet, but we're going to try. So I'm very excited for Las Vegas. The team is just like going on all cylinders right now. The momentum is through the roof, and we feel like the avalanche has just begun, and we got to just keep riding it.
There you go, man. I'm really excited for it. The last one's an easy one. What's next for Bitcoin Media, and where can people learn more about your company and your work?
Yeah, well, you can follow us at bitcoinmagazine.com or on Twitter at Bitcoin Magazine or the Bitcoin Conference. You can follow me on Twitter, David F. Bailey. And, you know, what's next? You said that's an easy one. It's not an easy one, man. Our biggest challenge is figuring out what we're going to say no to. But it's all things Bitcoin. We have some cool stuff cooking before the conference comes. Some cool announcements, some cool launches. And I think, you know, the next 18 months are going to be the most exciting 18 months in Bitcoin's history. And I hope we all get to ride it together, live it together, experience it together, and remember it together. So thank you for having me on the show. I enjoyed it.
Hey, thank you so much, Dave. It's been a pleasure. And I'm sure our listeners are going to really, really enjoy this one. So thanks again. How great was that? David is an amazing person, and I'm already looking forward to Bitcoin 2025 in Vegas. In our modern society, many feel disconnected from politics. They feel as though their voices aren't heard or their votes don't count. But David's story is a powerful reminder that this could not be further from the truth. The growing support for Bitcoin in US politics shows just how much influence voters and donors actually have. As the lobby for Bitcoin and crypto has gotten larger and more organized, politicians can no longer ignore it. Trump's campaign was quick to recognize this shift, taking the opportunity to engage with the industry and position themselves as allies. The strategy has also prompted the Democratic camp to rethink its stance. The goal now is to push for Bitcoin to become a nonpartisan issue, and that's a conversation we're starting to see emerge. Wherever you stand politically, it's crucial to acknowledge that these efforts are driving important discussions around Bitcoin and sensible regulation, which I believe will eventually gain bipartisan support. I want to give a huge thank you to David for his tireless work in advancing our industry and for putting together the largest annual Bitcoin conference year after year. Be sure to give him and Bitcoin Magazine a follow on social media. The links to that will be in our show notes. And I will be seeing you at Bitcoin 2025 in Vegas. As a preview of our next episode, you'll hear from one of the top voices in Kamala Harris's camp, who is helping stage the Democratic platform on Bitcoin and digital assets. Thanks again for listening, and see you soon. If you enjoyed this Because of Bitcoin episode, I would be very grateful for the 5 seconds it would take you to drop us a review and give us a rating on your favorite podcasting platform. This will really help us reach even more listeners. And if you'd like to learn more about Bitcoin, be sure to check out our newsletter by subscribing at ledn.io. That's ledn.io. Again, this was Mauricio Di Bartolomeo. Stay tuned for our next episode. And until then, muchas gracias y los quiero mucho. Ciao, ciao.